My name's Brewster Kahle. I'm the digital librarian at the Internet Archive, archive.org. It's a San Francisco not-for-profit library, and we're trying to, well, do archive everything. And so the whole idea of this talk is I'm going to try to argue that that statement is possible. The universal access to all knowledge is within our grasp. That may sound like a lot of hoo-ha, but I hope by the end of this talk you sort of say, hey, that's, one, it's possible, and two, I'd like to get involved, because it's actually going to take a whole bunch more of us to be able to pull this thing off. But I'd say it's probably the opportunity of our generation. It's the thing that we can really do that we'd be able to, I don't know, be really damn proud of. The idea of making it so that anybody, well, anywhere, can have access to the published works of humankind. All the books, all the music, all the video, all lectures. Some of it will be for free, and some of it will be for a fee. The fees will be covered by libraries, such that it's free to the people walking in, and some, if you get it delivered to your home, it will cost you something. But I think this general goal is the dream of the net. And I'd say it's more than that. It's the dream of the Library of Alexandria, that sort of, that Greek chutzpah, to go and say, yeah, let's do it all, right? They came up with the term encyclopedia, all knowledge, right? And then they had to actually team up with the Egyptians to get it done. And Alexandria, in 300 BC, by a lot of measures, got to around 75% of all the books of humankind. And they depended on a technology change, because the Assyrian libraries before them used clay tablets, which are really great for preservation, but really suck for access. I mean, these things are heavy, and the biggest Assyrian library is 15,000 tablets. But with papyrus, new technology, then they were able to get up to between 300,000 and 800,000 scrolls. I'd say we're depending on a new technology now, and it's these computers. These things can store a whole heck of a lot, and we can use the internet to try to get these materials anywhere. So that's sort of our opportunity technologically. But the biggest thing that's really going for us is a political will to live in an open society, to live in a society where the idea of education, where the idea of access to information is supported. Okay, around the fringes, my government, your government, well, we've got a few problems, but the basic, by and large, the idea is access to information is a good thing. And those are the three things: storage, the network to be able to get it anywhere, distribution, and the political will. And we've got all three of those for the first time in history. I don't know how long it will last. I think we have to actually build it fairly fast to try to build it into our basic idea of what it is we're to do. So to try to demonstrate this point, I'm going to try to ask you four questions. So this is that it's within our grasp. One, should we? I'm just going to hand wave and say yes, that it's worth doing. Sorry, you know, no philosophy here, just sort of enlightenment says, yeah, let's give this a shot. I mean, if it's a bad idea, let's find out that it's a bad idea and roll back. But let's actually see what we can do to get there. Another is, can we? Can we actually go and say we could do universal access to all published works, all books, music, video, web pages, software, the whole damn thing? Can we? May we? Right? What's the legal system have to say about this? What is our sort of basic social mores? That kind of thing. And the last, which I'm going to leave more or less as a exercise to the reader, is will we? And that I can't really answer. I'm going to say that I'm going to spend a lot of money and a lot of time trying to build it, but it's not going to be just by a bunch of folks in San Francisco. Texts. Let me go through the rooms of the library, if you will. Books, music, video, web and software. So these sort of, and basically try to answer the two middle questions. Can we actually go and archive the whole damn thing? And may we? And so let's start with books, or sort of starting with, say, Sumerian tablets. Books, how many are there? In the Library of Congress, there are about 26 million books, sort of catalog books. And that's the largest print library in the world. A book is about a megabyte. So 26 million megabytes is 26 terabytes. So 26 terabytes fits in a bookshelf that's about this big of Linux boxes. And it costs about $60,000. Right? all around doable, right? A house, Library of Congress. House, Library of Congress, right? Or in San Francisco, a garage, Library of Congress. So financially, the idea of storing a digitized version of the Library of Congress, if it's in image form, it's more than that, but it's still okay. It's a few of these bookshelves, but all around completely doable. How do you go about doing it? We're involved in a couple projects. I think there'll be more discussion later about texts. One is the Million Books Project, Gutenberg Project, those sorts of things. If you're trying to do images of pages of books, as best we can tell, it's about $10 a book. And so we're trying to do two ways of doing that. One is putting them on pallets and shipping them in India. So we bought 100,000 books to try this out and ship them to India. So if people have books and $10 each, sort of minimum lot of 2,000, would like to really get this thing reamed out. The other is to do it in library scanning, and we're trying with some robotics and some more custom stuff to try to get that to really work. But the Indian thing is really going. It's a $10 to you. So you put a $10 bill, or I guess on a book. With the technology, which is these overhead scanner things, it takes so long, and basically the people with the expertise are in India that know how to do this. We think we can do it in the UK, in the United States, in libraries. So we'd come to your library, set up this shop, and hire local people to basically do the manual labor and still make them $10, but we've got to get the technology to be a bit better, and we have to learn what the Indians have already learned. Well, it's not the most interesting work, but have you ever tried cataloging? libraries are kind of sweatshops for a while. But it's for a good cause. Some people really get into the groove. Other people, it's really just pulling teeth. It's really, really hard to sort of stay that focused. So it's not for everybody, but there are some people that really actually kind of like the whole ordeal. So that's scanning books. Making them available. So the idea of making them available on screens kind of sucks. And so we built a bookmobile. And I brought some books that we printed, that kids printed on bookmobile. Actually, the ones that would be kind of fun for here, brought Alice in Wonderland and London Town. I'll pass a few of these around. Please give them back. The idea is to have kids download, print, and bind their own books. So this bookmobile has got a little satellite dish on the top, and you download it with a printer, bind it, cut it, kids get their own books. It costs $1 to print and bind a book. If it's a black and white 100-page book, that means you can give it away. They did a study, Harvard, it costs $2 to loan out a book and get it back and put it back on the shelf. So it's cheaper, print it out, and give the book away. So this is pretty neat, and it's all because of this computer technology. So we now have a mechanism going from book to book. Book, scan it, compress it, put it on the net, catalog it, download it, print it, bind it, book. Book to book. And so we're really looking now to basically beef it up and get some more things through this process. So the idea of books is definitely within our grasp. Then there's the may we question. Out of copyright books, no sweat. Right, that's just an access issue. So if somebody actually owns one of the old books, then can we get access to it to be able to do the imaging, which isn't the easiest thing, but at least from the law perspective, it's okay. Then I'd like to break up the copyright issue into two sectors. There's the in print, which is tiny. The number of books that are actually in print and commercially viable is measured in the low hundreds of thousands. It's tiny. But there's this huge body of works that are copyrighted, but out of print, and you just can't get them. We call them the orphans, or abandonware. And this is just the tragedy of some of these just screwed up laws. And we in libraries have often, we live on making out of print materials available to people. But it looks like in this copyright regime on the internet, this is being denied us. So we're asking for a clarification in the United States. And the way that we do that in the United States is we file a lawsuit. So there's a lawsuit that's been filed. It's Cale v. Ashcroft. And the idea is to see if we can free the orphans and make it so that we can actually take care of them and give them a happy home. So we'll see if we can actually make some progress in the United States on getting there for the out of print materials. Then we've started to launch more of these bookmobiles. There are two of them out of their first 30 in India. This is paid for by the Indian government. This was the launch day of the one in the Library of Alexandria in Egypt. I'm sort of surrounded in this whole crowd of folks. And it's going around to the schools around Alexandria and around. Our bookmobile costs us $15,000 to make, including the car, right? So it just doesn't cost that much to make these things if you're frugal. This is an engineer working with a kid and a happy customer of the Alexandrian collection. And then we got some World Bank funding and spun off a not-for-profit called Anywhere Books to do a bookmobile project in rural Uganda. So it's working. That we basically can do this stuff quickly and easily with just a week of training. People can be out there printing and binding books. So books all around, I'd say, are within our grasp. Let's go for audio. So books, music, video, audio. So music. So the question is sort of how much is there? Can we actually go and digitize the whole darn thing? If you take the published works of audio, almost all of them are music, and they've it's about 2 to 3 million of them, right, in terms of 78s and LPs and CDs. That's the total sort of output of humans since recorded music started, recorded sound really came about, at least in terms of the saleable units. So all around, that's a doable number, right? You could sort of imagine a few of these bookshelves kind of ripping through this stuff. And when you're getting to those large numbers, you're getting to sort of the outskirts of music, sort of the interesting areas of types of music that aren't the mainstream. And having access to that type of material is fantastic. Then the question is how much access can we bring to this? And right now, the whole music area is a very litigated area. So we've been walking fairly carefully. And the first area that we've really concentrated on is jam bands. So there's this tradition within the jam bands started by Grateful Dead to allow the tape recording of their concerts and trading among their fans as long as no one makes any money. Very important, no one's making any money. So the idea is if you can go and tape it, and so you could show how great a Deadhead you were by how big your collection is and how close they are to the originals, right? You know, how many tape generations there are. So we this moved on to the internet, and we made the offer to the taper community that have these concerts in losslessly compressed wave files, usually shuns and flacks. They don't believe in compression because it poisons the trading pool. Our kind of guys. So these concerts are about a gigabyte. So it's not for the light of downloading, but it's becoming much more commonly available. And they had real problems with bandwidth. They put them up on a university server for a little while, announce it on their mailing list, and take it down when they got in trouble. So we went and asked this this community, would you like unlimited storage and unlimited bandwidth forever for free? They didn't believe us. But then they came back and said, but that would be our dream. Right? The idea to be able to have access to all this great music, you know, if you're a string cheese incident guy, you know, this, you know, you really want to know what was that May 17th. But usually people go back to hear the concerts that they went to. So we went and asked the bands, because it's a little different from trading to go and post it on the internet. And most of them have said yes. We get a band saying yes every day. They have to send email to etree@archive.org. And then the fans start grinding along, going and making the recordings and putting them up. And so we have String Cheese Incident, Yonder Mountain String Band, Fugazi, a bunch of bands, mostly within the guys with guitars genre, but some with sort of guys with mandolins and other things. And it's now 12,000 concerts. So it's growing at about 20 or 30 a day. We've just brought on another couple years of the Grateful Dead. I think we're almost complete. So the idea is to get, as if people want to share, we'll provide unlimited bandwidth and unlimited storage forever for free. Really. As long as people can put it under something like a Creative Commons license or something that allows us to archive it and make it available to people for free. And it's sort of broadly defined belongs in a library. So this has been starting to be in our niche. We flatlined 130 megabits per second, and then we got four times that at 500 megabits per second. It took us about 2 months to flatline that. If you look at our bandwidth graph, it's kind of your. But people seem to still be happy with it, and we're putting in another gigabit in the United States, and we're putting in a gigabit here in Europe. So I think we're in pretty good shape for access to jam band music. So if you guys know people in bands, if you're in bands, if you want recordings to be made available, it's a great tradition in the United States. I'd love to see some more European bands in this collection. Oh, another thing on audio. In the U.S., the copyright law for performances, recorded performances, is really hard to figure out. But in Europe, there's a 50-year rule. If the underlying composition, if the songwriter has been dead for 50 or 70 years, depending on what country, the performance only has a 50-year rule. So everything from 1954 on back is public domain in Europe. And we better hustle. To go and get a lot of that online. So that basically gives us the 78s era. So if you know people with 78s or you've got some expertise in going and digitizing 78s, let's go at it. We've got some work to do. And it won't be long before the American lawyers spend a lot of time and effort trying to change this law for you guys. So if we go and set the line and say, no, we're not going to lose the 50-year rule in Europe, I think we can actually do some interesting things. I think it would be really fun to have hip-hop songs built out of scratches of 78s. They're some of our most popular things on the archive now. We also have net labels, which are internet genre labels, and those have been also doing very well. We've got about 50 net labels that we're hosting, and one guy at a conference I was at last week said that his net label would have gone under for bandwidth fees if the archive hadn't stepped in and made them available. So what they do is they move their content onto the archives file servers, and they point directly from their websites to the files. So they don't have to go through the archives branding or anything. It's just as if it's just a straight link. So you click on it from their website and you get the file. But you can also get to it from the archives website. And that seems to be working pretty well. So moving images. So I'm trying to go through and say basically this is possible, at least in parts of it, to show that this stuff can work. Moving images. Most people think of it as sort of the big theatrical releases. There are about 100,000 to 200,000 of them. It's been estimated about half of them are Indian. But most of those are fairly copyrighted and fairly litigated. There's a guy that's collected public domain feature films. He's got about 600 of them. And we're in the process of digitizing those and making them all available for free. So The Night of the Living Dead turns out is public domain. It's very popular. So we have all these, and we're digitizing them and making them available at DVD quality, as well as MPEG-1 and a couple versions of MPEG-4. We're really trying to stick to the open standards, even though those standards have got bad patent problems. So it's starting to move along in the feature area, but we're fairly limited in that. But we're a lot less limited is all sorts of other kinds of interesting films. I was showing one before of just little clips from the Preilinger archives, and there are other people that have these collections of older movies that happen just not be copyrighted. Because it used to be that you had to assert copyright, otherwise it wasn't copyrighted. It was sort of the Ben Franklin way of viewing the world, and I think actually Ben Franklin was kind of smart. Some people think that Jack Valenti is a whole lot smarter than all of the founding fathers combined, but I think there might be a debate there. And And so we're the old ways of registering left it to lots of material that was not being taken care of is now available. And people are using this to make all sorts of new art out of. They're downloading it, and it's really fun stuff. Government films, educational films, social guidance films, oddball stuff, home movies, those sorts of things. And again, we'll offer you, if you've digitized any of your works, any of your video holdings, unlimited storage, unlimited bandwidth, forever, for free. Right? So the idea of going and storing a couple gigabyte file is no sweat to us. We have no problem with it. Upload away, and lots of people will enjoy it. Television comes fairly large. We're a little delayed on getting started this. We started recording television in 1999 with a partner organization called the Television Archive. Just hit the record button. For 20 channels, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Palestinian, BBC, CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, 20 channels of this, 24 hours a day, DVD quality. Turns out to be about 20 terabytes a month. We started by putting it on tape, and now it's on hard drives that are offline. We've only made 1 week available. It was September 11th, 2001 to September 18th, 2001, and we made it available on October 11th. The idea is to try to get an idea of what did the world see. It was basically a television event in that sort of pure McLuhan way. But the question is sort of how do people perceive it? I think we're starting to really get an idea that the media is just a player. It is not the truth, it is a player, and we want multiple points of view. And the internet offers us an ability to get these multiple points of view. But we've only made a small fraction of our collections available until we sort of get some of the rights issues and sort of how to do this such that people are happy with it. So television, I would say, is also within our grasp. We do have something that is up on the archive that's really interesting. It's called the Mosaic Program. It's a half an hour every day that goes and takes the 16 channels from the Middle East and cuts it up and translates parts of it and packages it for a Western audience. If you want to know what's on the news in the Middle East, go take a look at the Mosaic Program. It's archived on the archive, but it's also through their website on Link TV. Fascinating stuff, and I'd like to see a lot more of this kind of thing to really understand what the world is looking for. So moving images, yes, we can go and archive the whole damn thing, and we could make it available, but may we? We're in the process of figuring that out. Paula is here from the BBC, who's running their Creative Archives project. They're doing fantastic stuff, absolutely world-leading things. Put some good support behind the BBC. They're walking way out there on a limb. And let's, you know, hooray for the BBC. Software. There are about 50,000 titles of software, as best we can tell, that were packaged and released. So, we know where about 21,000 of them are. But we ran into, so all around that's doable, right? You've got these guys here, they've made hacks of stuff. All around it's doable to go and rip this stuff, write emulators, and be able to preserve these amazing creative works from the early personal computer and Mac and Sol and MSI and Commodore 64 and the BBC Micro, whatever it is. So it is possible, and it's all around within our grasp, but we ran into a problem in the United States. It was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is just this amazing piece of Soviet-era legislation where everything's illegal unless we give you permission. It's really the antithesis of what the United States used to stand for. But anyway, it's our rule of law, and it made it so that ripping software was illegal. The idea of breaking its access and copy protections, with a lot of the early stuff had. So we went to the Copyright Office, and with a lot of preparation and briefs and da-da-da-da-da, said, here's Lotus 1-2-3. It's on this floppy format. Do you remember this? Yes, have you ever tried to read one recently? Basically said, it's all rotting. We're perfectly up for going and making digital copies of these and living under the existing copyright regime, before the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. We just have to be allowed to do it. And we got a copyright exemption. We changed the law. The software industry said it was just awful. How can you possibly want to go and preserve old software? But anyway, we librarians won on this case. And we've got an exemption that lasts for 3 years. We have to hustle. So we are looking for help. So there's some of the best work has been done here in the UK, the CAPS project. We're looking for donations of the physical objects as well as the ripped stuff. Because we think when the way the laws are likely to evolve, it will become difficult if you don't have the original thing to have a digital copy. So if you have old software, please rip it and send it to us. We can handle, you know, pay for some of the transport, whatever. We've got to make some huge progress in the next 2 years. We need your help. So we actually went through and we got the exemption. Now it's our chance. We've got 2 years and the window may shut. But if we go and show real progress during these 2 years, when the hearings come around again, we can go and show that the world actually didn't crater the way the software industry said, because somebody could actually go to someplace and play one Lotus 1-2-3 as it originally was written.
Don't you have to rip it?
No, we don't have to rip it.
So we're allowed to rip it on the current law?
If you're working as an agent for us, we believe so. I'm not exactly sure how it all works, but it's quite restricted. I mean, the legal exemption is pretty much just for the ripping. Going and posting it is, you know, we have to win that other suit, the KLV Ashcroft, to try to get some of the orphaned works, the abandonware, law changed. So that stuff is still dicey. Okay? Last is the web. We're probably best known for archiving the web. It is possible to do, or at least to do as well as we're doing it. We hope that we're going to get better at it. We've been archiving the web since 1996, taking a full snapshot every 2 months of all of the publicly available websites, all the text, all the pictures, basically try to make it so you can surf the web as it was. It's growing along. It's getting bigger. We're archiving about 20 terabytes each month of compressed data. So it's maybe about 50 or 60 terabytes of web content each month is sort of the rate of ingest. And we made a thing called the Wayback Machine. Has anybody used the Wayback Machine? All right. So if you go to archive.org, you can type in your old URL and try to surf the web as it was, or as well as we've archived it. And try to make use of it. There was also a gal that made a search engine, which I'll hit in a moment. So this is Heaven's Gate. These guys were web designers, and they committed mass suicide when Hale-Bopp went by because they thought, well, I don't know. Anyway, you can read about it on their website. It's in the Wayback Machine. This is Yahoo as it looked in 1996. It was kind of clean then, wasn't it? And kind of like Google. We'll see what happens to Google in 8 years. So this is used by about 150,000 people a day. We get about 8 million hits a day. That's about 100 hits a second on average throughout the day. It's a large database. You know, it's sort of on the order of 300 or 400 terabytes now of compressed data. So I don't know. It's just probably over a petabyte. I think it's the largest database. It, of course, doesn't run on Oracle. It runs on a cluster of Linux machines, and it runs with flat files. It's the only way that we've been able to find to have things scale. And so these sorts of databases can actually do this kind of hit rate with just generic boxes. So how do we preserve this stuff, and how do we provide access to it? I'd say we're doing an okay job and an okay job, or when I went to school, it would be F and F. But at least we're trying, and we're getting a progressive better at the preservation and the access. So the idea is, what do you store these things on? Well, it has to be very cost-effective storage, and at this point, tapes are cost ineffective, but hard drives are doing just fine. So we use Linux boxes, lots of them. We just stacked them up. So it's a Linux box. You can put 4 hard drives in it, 300 gigabyte hard drives. That's 1.2 terabytes. And you just basically just keep thumping these away and put them on shelves. Then the question is, you know, we're pretty conscious in San Francisco of being in the San Andreas fault line. Right? Great, let's have the only archive of the web be in San Francisco. So we thought, well, gosh, this doesn't sound like a good idea. You know, the lesson from the first Library of Alexandria, I guess the Library of Alexandria is probably best known for burning, right? It's not here. I've been able to see a scan of a piece of papyrus, one of 8 that they think was actually in the Library of Alexandria, right? The center of all ancient learning is so completely gone, they only think 8 maybe pieces of papyrus has lasted since then. So the answer is, don't just have one copy. So we're in the process of making more copies. We started this by actually working with the new Library of Alexandria. And we made a deal with the new head of Alexandria. We would start off their collection if they'd continue it. And everything we get goes to them, and everything they get goes to us. A huge swap. The idea is to build an international library system with 5 or 6 of these nodes around the world. Petabyte, tens of gigabits, real stuff. If you walk into the new Library of Alexandria and turn to your right, you see this. And I really recommend going down there. It's a wonderful place. It's a very uplifting place, people. Pretty amazing. But this is the first 100 terabytes, and they want to catch up they want to do it by October, which I'm not sure we're going to be able to do, to be able to give them the other 700 terabytes or some such that they'd need to be able to come up to date. Good news on another front, the reason why I'm here is I'm living in Europe, in Amsterdam, for the last month and the next month. I moved my whole family here, and we're trying to kick off a European archive, and we need your help. So, in black and white, this is what it looks like. If you want to see it in color, you have to go there. This is the first installment. It's a 100 terabyte machine we designed for Europe. So it is a stack of 41U machines that are back to back. So they're 80 in a rack, 1.2 terabytes times 80 gets you 100 terabytes in a rack. So that's the first installment to show that we're serious. That's sort of the entry card. And basically, we'll be rolling out the full petabyte sort of through the next 12 months. The idea is to start off the European archive and try to get people around it that are helping. It's been great. Amsterdam's been fantastic. We now have free hosting and free bandwidth from Access for All and SurfNet, which is amazing. We're getting a lot of volunteer help. And we're looking for a tech director for this thing. So if a petabyte doesn't scare you, if running 800 machines doesn't scare you, if occasionally holding a screwdriver doesn't scare you, we're looking for somebody that would basically be the tech director of the European archive. We have enough funding for basically one and a half, two people from the Internet Archive, and then basically wait a while and build up the monies coming from Europe. We're looking to transfer some of our contracts from some of the European libraries that we're working with to help get this thing really kicked off. So we're looking for content. What is really exciting to folks in the UK that we should put on this, that we'd be able to have gigabit access to, right? What is the things that you have that you can't put online yet from a technical perspective? We'd like to not really go into the wares front, and so go for Creative Commons license type materials, and let's have some fun. So that's some of our preservation strategy. So access, well, it's gotten popular. This was just when we turned it up to 500 megabits, and now if we sort of draw out the graph, we think we're around 2 gigabits if we were uncapped. So we're trying to get up into that realm. We think if we get up into this sort of several gigabit realm to 10 gigabits, we're starting to be a meaningful percentage of the public web. And I think that's the right place for the commons. The commons really is an amazing part of the web. And what we're finding is people are willing to help build the commons and provide access to the commons for free. And so let's go and build a fantastic, rich commons. Some people are doing interesting search engines. This is a search engine by a woman named Anna Patterson. It indexes 11 billion web pages. She used the Internet Archive infrastructure, and she spent, I think, about 2 years part-time as she was raising her infant to build this. I find it kind of amazing that she could write a search engine that is four times the size of Google's in terms of the pages by one person on top of an architecture or an infrastructure that's provided. That's what we libraries do, is provide content resources for people to do research. And this has got a time-based thing, which is really cool. So if you search on marine life, you can see how marine life is correlated with different terms over time and how popular it is. This is if you search on homeland security. Oops. So it sort of wasn't used before, and now, bam, that's sort of the use of it. If you look Brewster Kahle up, you see I kind of peaked in 1998 in terms of my... Lawrence Lessig is still on the way up. I'm jealous as hell. So I've got to really start doing something such that the more of the web pages mention Brewster Kahle. And over on the side there, auto-categorization. And she's happily working now at Google after getting a lot of money. So there's room for researchers to do good work. The idea is to make it so that there's a Google a month. What is the new ideas out there that we can go and do because we've got these content resources that are available for research purposes for free? Another thing we're doing is wireless. The access problem in the United States is really pathetic. We've got phone companies that are not getting better. My DSL line, basically, unlike Moore's Law, which gets better, these guys don't. They're pretty much the same, and they want to raise the prices. So we've made these wireless boxes, and we make them for about $1,000. Actually, we spun off a little company and said, we'll buy a bunch of them if you go into business. So it's $1,000 installed, and there are about 30 of these nodes around San Francisco, and I'd say it only works okay. But it's a fairly large rooftop-to-rooftop 802.11b network, and we provide the bandwidth for free. Bandwidth's really cheap, so that's not a big problem. It's actually the support issues that really take up the time and effort, and getting a couple really good locations. So if you want to use these or buy these things from this guy, he's in Oregon, please do. But this is another project towards providing access. We really need it so that movies commonly happen. If the internet really stays at this sort of pathetic, video at sort of this size and really slow, I think it will become cute. We'll bypass the internet. I mean, it just won't be what it is people turn to for their information if we don't get video online now and reamed all the way out. So if you've got content, please, we've got infrastructure. We can serve it for free. If you can make these 802.11 networks, make it so that we can get 3 megabits per second now and then move up on Moore's Law so it doubles in speed every year, that's what we need. When HDTV comes around, we need all these networks to be basically ready for it. So this is an opportunity that we're also seeding. I don't know the answer to this question. I really don't. There are a bunch of forces and people that are trying to make it not happen, but mostly it seems like a good idea. Most people are smiling and want this to happen. We're finding help in all sorts of areas. We're getting funding now from private foundations, Hewlett Foundation, Sloan Foundation, my own foundation based on selling a couple internet companies, Library of Congress, British National Library, Public Records Office. So we're really sort of cranking along. We're about $5 million a year. We want to get up to around $10 million a year. And that's sort of our realm, and then we need to basically build some of these things up around the world to do the large-scale repository. But we also have to get together and start digitizing some of this material and putting pressure on so that we can make them accessible. And you guys are perfect for this. I'd say it was just a great career direction for me. So if you're looking for sort of something that's really meaningful, that's going to, in 15 years, make it so you spring out of bed in the morning saying, I want to go to work, I find this digital librarian stuff just a blast. that it really is something that's interesting and complex from technical, legal, and social reasons. Universal access to all human knowledge. What I wanted to do through this talk was try to argue that that is actually possible. Personally, I think it could be one of humanity's greatest achievements. I think it could be up there with the Library of Alexandria, the myth of the Library of Alexandria, by making not only the Library of Alexandria, but making it available to that kid in rural Uganda. Make it so that if he's HIV positive, he can actually get access to new lectures, not some dumb pamphlet of what. How does he help himself? I think it could be up there with the man on the moon at the end of by the end of the decade kind of thing. I think it is that sort of a few years of really hardcore work, and we could do a heck of a lot towards getting our archives up and out there. Thank you very much. So, did people get a chance to see this book? Did anybody see the books over there? Yeah? Are they making them around? So keep passing them around. They're pretty interesting that you can actually print and bind these things. But there's only one. Is there more floating around? Here, please give them back at the end, but pass them around. Good. Any questions? Corey. Yeah, we have this curatorial process to try to basically try to get rid of the wares issue. And so we have volunteer curators. So what I'd love to suggest is please volunteer to be a curator. Simon Carlos, who is sort of doing a bunch of the software hacking and does a bunch of stuff for Slashdot, we've now started to employ him to try to push some more of these things through. But that's been our approach. We have the idea of just having it completely open. We haven't done yet. Maybe we should experiment with that and see if it's abused. But
what if I could put up a web page and then ask the archive to mirror the web page? Right? Put it in the web page, and then
certainly you can do that. That process takes a little bit longer technically currently, but we're trying to ream that one out. So point well taken. Quick question, sir. Please help. I mean, we're doing the dopiest stuff, the sort of the review. How do you find stuff in audio and video? So were you still using text tagging and people are writing reviews, which actually helps a bunch? We'd like to do more of the collaborative filtering things, but people are doing shot lists and contributing to them. So there have been these people that there's 2,000 Preilinger archive movies. There's these completely cool movies, and they've taken upon themselves to review every one of them. and that helps somewhat, but it doesn't really help you when you say, I need a postman walking past a city building, which is often what people, when they're doing stock footage, are looking for. So if you have any ideas, this content repository is there. We did do this sort of snapshot every minute, so you can click on it to go and browse a long movie to sort of see at least what every minute looked like. That often helps give an idea, but we don't have a good structure, I wouldn't say. Yes? Yes. Well, I don't know. There is the how do you distribute the archive? Can we do sort of archive at home? Yeah. And there are some research projects. One's Ocean Store, and everybody, you know, every time these, you know, incredibly well-funded government projects, I say, whenever you're ready for a terabyte, let me know. And they just say, And you know, there's the Lots of Copies Keep Stuff Safe project at Stanford. but they're really oriented around journal articles and tiny things. When we're dealing with this many terabytes, it's going to be a little more challenging. So if you have ideas, please, let's try it. But right now, we're looking for people that will stand up and take institutional responsibility. We're trying to keep the costs down. So this petabyte machine costs $2 million. That's not a lot, right? You know, probably the computer science department of this place could buy a petabyte machine that has 800 machines in it, be a supercomputer and an archive, and be on JISC's network, Janet, here, and it would be really cool. Hopefully by keeping the price down, more people can buy in. But how to use sort of the peer-to-peer networks to really do archiving, I don't know. We're trying to use peer-to-peer for distribution, and we've been basically unsuccessful. It hasn't helped very much, but we're not giving up yet. Yes, sir. Yeah, we have lots of hardware failures. in fact, IBM Almaden, the disk guys, study ours to get an idea of and as best I can tell, the hard drives fail at 6% per year. Not of all of it. Not of all of it. So some of it is wilting at this point when we get the occasional failures, and it's not that occasional. So that's why to have copies in other places. And those on that first slide, there's this rack, or there's a racks, and they had little ties. These things come in pairs. So we do raid basically by machine to machine, not within itself. We've had a horrible time using raid. But we think if we mirror between each other, so we have two copies within the cluster, and then also on other continents, that we should kind of have preservation for at least a couple centuries. That's our goal.
You're not going to put something on Google Plus?
No, I don't even quite know what that is. Yeah, there's some paper on it, but we keep things very, very simple. The idea is to make system administration easy to understand, so that basically anybody that has graduated college with a Linux box under their dorm desk would recognize everything about the archive, because we find training is one of the biggest issues we've got. We've got to get people through. So keeping things really, really dopey simple, we call it brute simple, has been our technique all the way through. It's not necessarily the best technique, it's what we've been doing. Anything else? Sir? Somebody said so. Oh, how do we know whether it's what it is that people said it was? And we don't really. It's all sort of provenance. We try to record where we got it from, but that and as much as we can, that the person sort of uploading it, if it's coming from the general public. If we crawled it, then we say sort of exactly not only what the domain name we used, so the full URL, but also the IP address that we used, and date and time and blah, 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 blah. But we can be spoofed, and I'm not sure how to get around that. We do have people watching, and so basically what these curators do, they sort of watch over the collections as things come online. But those are, you know, it's volunteer pools of experts in their domains. Yeah. Yeah, again? How old is data? We just know when we've collected it.
Yeah.
That. Oh yeah. Well, we write down whatever it is we find off the boxes or whatever. Sure. Everything's cataloged. We have an RSS feed of what's going into the archive. It's completely great. So yesterday, 2 days ago, I saw something come into the open audio archives. So this is the place that it's sort of a grab bag of all sorts of open archives. And it was something dated 1889. I was like, ooh, that looks like a typo. but no, it was President Benjamin Harrison speaking on a wax drum recording. It was the first recording of a president. So kind of fun. So we see some old stuff coming through. Yeah. Do we archive illegal things? We archive everything we can get a hold of, and we make them as accessible as we're allowed to.
So, yes. Yes. Ben Franklin had 14 years renewable once. I think that's a good idea. I think it's still a good idea. The idea that I realized that people were moving a lot faster in 1776, you know, it was really sort of hopping. It really does take us 100 years to get done what they could get done in 14 years. But I realized, but we should probably make the sacrifice. So yeah, I think copyright should be a shorter term. This software stuff should maybe be more like 5 years. And it should be a trade-off for getting protection from the government. If the government's going to go break down somebody's door for breaking copyright, well, the copyright owner should probably go and deposit a copy someplace. And all that stuff went away. And it's really going the wrong way. We need some reform. Yes?
I think it's great that you're doing this initially off your own back and later with various small organizations. But how would you feel about handing off to, say, a commercial organization that we'll keep your values, but we'll monetize it for the, you know, make it available for free to find some way of monetizing it, like Google taking over the Internet Archive or someone else like that, or equally a government that said, we buy into this. Would you be prepared to hand off with supervision? Have you already been negotiating that? Just in case.
Actually, it goes the other way, usually. Publishers and libraries have always worked in tandem. So it's always been this sort of we run in parallel. So when I started the company Alexa Internet, I also started the Internet Archive on the same day. And in it, we wrote a contract to donate everything that the Alexa Internet receives with a 6-month time delay to the Internet Archive. And that's where basically a lot of the holdings of the Internet Archive came from. So actually what I'd really like to do is have the archives be less active in many ways, and working with commercial entities to do interesting, cool stuff on top of it, but always have the core materials be owned in the public, under the bright, shining public light, to make sure that we're doing the right thing. I'm a card-carrying capitalist. I've done very well by capitalism. But there are lots of things that you don't want capitalism to do, like archive stuff. They'll only do it for as long as it's commercially valuable to them. And so Google is moving along and doing all sorts of digitization projects of books, music, video, all sorts of things that haven't been announced yet. It's best I can tell. I don't know anything that I'm not supposed to know. But I really worry about that. So my dream case would be, as those people are digitizing, let them have it for, say, 5 years so that they get a commercial cream, but then put them in nonprofit archives. I really believe in the .org sector. I think that we are motivated very differently. Life is more complex. The people that work in our field tend to be different. We're motivated differently. And I think it works well in tandem.
Two more questions.
Sir.
Who's going to pay for all this in 200 years' time?
Who's going to pay for this in 200 years' time? We are. If it's valuable, we are. The library system in the United States is between $12 billion and $24 billion each year. We believe in this stuff. The Library of Congress itself is a $500 million a year. I don't know what the UK is, but libraries are a major civil institution. So that's 12 billion to 24 billion. We're 5 million, right? I think we could grow a little bit, and I don't think we'd be impacting what it is society could stomach. The idea is to also be able to try to make it through dark ages. But that's sort of a harder. Our strategy there is to make copies in other places. Because while Europe went through its dark age, the Arab world and China were doing just peachy. So the idea is to try to route around problems. At least things would have been around for the last 4,000 years continuously if we'd adapted these strategies before. Sir. What's my relationship with Stuart Brand's Long Now Foundation? I'm not officially a member of that organization, but I think I'm responsible for the idea of the Rosetta Project. So there are a bunch of us that puzzled on this when I was in a technical college back in the United States, of sort of how do you have things last through a dark age? And the idea of putting things on a disk and writing them really small so they could be read with an optical microscope in 3,000 to 5,000 years. Sort of turned out to be, and they've spent a bunch of time making one of them, and I bought one. It's actually completely cool. So so yeah, it's 1,000 languages. It's meant to be the Rosetta disk. So it's a common text in 1,000 different languages. So that basically, if you find this thing, hopefully you can decode a bunch of languages. We're friends. They used to be upstairs in my building, but I'm not on their board and they're not on mine. But you know, it's a small.